loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Today we have a special episode. We are joined for the full hour by legendary British parliamentarian and anti-war crusader George Galloway. He is currently running for mayor of London in an election that will be held in May 2016. George Galloway campaigned against the economic sanctions on Iraq during the 1990s. He was a leading voice in the international mass anti-war movement that swept the globe in 2002 and 2003 in an effort to stop the unprovoked invasion of Iraq. He has been an outspoken voice in defense of the Palestinian people and in opposition to growing xenophobic and racist attacks against Muslim communities in Europe and right here in the United States. George Galloway, welcome.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for that kind introduction.
Well, thanks for joining us. This coming March 19th will mark the 13th anniversary of the U.S. and British invasion of Iraq, the Coalition of the Willing, I guess we could call it. Today, Iraq is in fragments, as is most of the Middle East. That once beautiful country has been shredded and lives in a state of endless war. Bush and Blair are pretty comfortable, making lots of money. In the United States, the Senate just unveiled a statue for Dick Cheney, and Bush stood next to him, thanking him for his great work. Why, George Galloway, no accountability for high officials who perhaps and perhaps indeed committed war crimes and crimes against humanity?
Well, you very eloquently summed up the situation. In fact, not only has there been no accountability, there has been apparently endless reward for all these people who are either guilty of stupidity on an Everest scale or worse than stupidity, venality, corrupt wickedness. But whatever it is, they've been endlessly rewarded. Tony Blair, I've just made a film called The Killings of Tony Blair, it will be out quite soon, has made more than £100 million, so that's $160 million in 8 years since leaving office. In fact, in Britain, the only people who lost their jobs over the Iraq war were those of us who opposed it. I was expelled from the Labour Party after 36 years of membership. Greg Dyke, the chairman of the BBC, was sacked. Andrew Gilligan, a BBC reporter who unmasked some important truths in the run-up to the war, he was sacked. Piers Morgan, now well known in the United States through television, through succeeding for a little while at least, the legendary talk show host that he stepped in for, he got sacked. So there's been no accountability for those who, as I say, were either fools or knaves. If they were fools, they were too stupid to be in control of events. If they were knaves, they were too wicked to be. But they seem to have prospered. And that's because the deep state and the media echo chamber, which serves that deep state, have closed ranks around them. And even though they have done such damage, even to that deep state, they continue to prosper.
Yes, I mean, we keep getting bits and pieces, sometimes with great media sort of announcements about its importance, and then sometimes it just sort of slithers out. But information showing that all of the explanations for the war, the pretext for the war, the public rationales for the war, which shifted from time to time and sort of rotated in a circular fashion, that all of those rationales were in fact not the result of an intelligence failure, but were just lies. And recently, when the court ordered the release of 30,000 pages of emails by Hillary Clinton when she was then Secretary of State, some of those emails revealed that the Bush-Blair team were very, very deep in it, in conspiracy with each other, to convince a skeptical public And in the case of the Labour Party in Britain, a Labour Party that was not just skeptical, but largely opposed to the Iraq invasion, that they were involved in a real effort to lie to the public. Is that how you see it?
Yes, we shouldn't entirely exclude the stupidity option. If you don't mind my saying, I don't want to sound in any way xenophobic, but the US president might have had stupidity as an excuse. The British Prime Minister certainly didn't. He had a very expensive Oxford education paid for by me as a worker throughout his time in Oxford University. But either stupidity or venality, either fools or knaves, it's very difficult to believe that it was just stupidity. I know that sometimes we're led not by James Bonds but by Austin Powers. But the deep state in both countries must be smart enough to know that the dangers that they were running were simply horrendous. Certainly millions of people without their salaries on the streets of Washington, D.C., where you are, and I was amongst them once or twice, and on the streets of London and across the world. We were not too stupid to know that the story that we were being told, the narrative that we were being spun, was false, except where it was a deliberate falsehood. So my own conclusion is that they were lying, that they knew that what they were saying was untrue, but they believed that they would succeed. I don't know if it was Shakespeare, certainly an English writer once said that treason never prospers, for if it prospers, none dare call it treason. If their war had been a success, you and I would have been out of business and we wouldn't be having this conversation now. The fact that we're very much in business is because it didn't prosper, because it turned into the worst cataclysmic disaster, as bad as our most extreme option on our range of possible outcomes. I mean, I was looking back for other reasons at what I was writing and saying at the time. And sometimes I get full marks for prescience. But as a matter of fact, even I considerably underestimated the sheer scale of the disaster that would ensue. You summed it up in your introduction. Iraq is atomized, broken into pieces, probably never to be put together again. Syria, ditto. Extremism, fanaticism has cascaded across the entire world, from San Bernardino to the streets of London to throughout the Middle East, almost without exception, from the Atlantic to the Gulf. There are people running around with sharp knives seeking to eat other people's hearts. It is almost impossible to exaggerate the nightmarish proportions of what has come about, and come about directly as a result of actions taken by our leaders.
Yeah, George Galloway, I agree with you. There is this toxic combination of fecklessness, stupidity, short-sightedness, imperial hubris, and then the capacity to use power arrogantly and to use the corporate-owned media as nothing but an echo chamber to repeat government lies in the service of whatever policy they're pursuing. And some people, of course, think that the United States designed as sort of a grand, with the British government, a grand conspiracy to undo the Middle East. Others think it's the consequence or the unintended consequences of short-sighted, stupid, ridiculous, and imperial policies that have broken apart the Middle East, making, of course, the lives of the people in that area, first and foremost, the people in Iraq, so much more miserable, so much more in a catastrophic state. And yet it did not succeed in terms of the imperial designs to completely pacify and control this oil-rich and geostrategically important part of the world. So we have this kind of toxic combination, certainly. But I want to go further into that in this show. I want to talk to you about the rise of ISIL and what the governments in Britain, in France, in the United States plan to do about it, what the likely outcome of that will be. But first, I want to stay on the topic of the deliberate misleading of the public. Now, Tony Blair and Bush said at March 19, 2003, that they had to carry out the invasion of Iraq, even though there was no UN support for it. Very few countries in the world supported it. Most people in the world opposed it. They had to because Iraq posed such a grave menace, even while weapons inspectors from the United Nations were still carrying out the disarmament program that the Iraqi government had complied with. But we have in these documents, especially the memo from Colin Powell to George W. Bush, written a week before Tony Blair shows up at the Crawford Ranch in April 2002, where Blair and Bush then, it seems, actually consummate the plan for the invasion of Iraq. This memo says, quote, "Blair continues to stand by you, George W. Bush, and the U.S. as we move forward on the war on terrorism and on Iraq. On Iraq, Blair will be with us should military operations be necessary. He is convinced on 2 points. The threat is real, and success against Saddam will yield more regional success." That shows, one, that Tony Blair was, in fact, planning to carry out the war on Iraq in advance, a year ahead of time. And two, that there were other goals. What does he mean by more regional success? I mean, that's not weapons of mass destruction. That's some other geopolitical design. What were Blair and Bush, if Bush was thinking at all, or certainly Rumsfeld and Cheney, what were they thinking?
Well, I think that the Crawford, Texas meeting was the seminal meeting. Our film, The Killings of Tony Blair, nails that down, I think, which means that Blair systematically lied to the parliament, to the public, to the Queen, to the armed forces, to the diplomatic service, and so on, for fully 13 months thereafter, when he was insisting that war was not inevitable, and even actually that Saddam Hussein could stay in power if he divested himself of weapons of mass destruction. These were all lies. I don't think anyone could argue that that in this case stupidity is an option. These were systematic lies that were hatched, and I do understand that both men got down on their knees and prayed together at Crawford, just a couple of weeks after the Powell memorandum was written, and prayed for the success of their hideous, evil plan, which involved, of course, turned out to involve at least the mass murder of a million people. That's quite a mountain of people if you pause to imagine it. They were lying through their teeth by that stage, and the echo chamber you referred to was quite a sight to behold, you know. Again, for this movie, we've been reviewing. It's easy, actually, at this distance, to have forgotten just how ferocious it all was. The propaganda machine, when it's in full war mode, is quite a sight to behold. Hardly a child in the world did not know who Saddam Hussein was, why Iraq was a danger, why it had to be invaded and destroyed, because the mass media and the political masters of that echo chamber made sure of that. Powell comes out of that memorandum, indeed the entire Iraq story, in disgrace, as does Jack Straw, another little remembered British Foreign Secretary at the time. And, of course, Bush and Blair are the main criminals in the piece. It was a very big crime, perhaps the biggest crime for half a century or more. And it was, to paraphrase, worse than a crime. It was a blunder. It was a crime that went spectacularly wrong. And we're all going to be paying a price for that for generations to come. Children yet unborn will pay the price for that gigantic crime, for that gigantic blunder.
You know, I interviewed Lawrence Wilkerson recently for this show, and he was Colin Powell's chief of staff during the first 4 years of the George W. Bush administration. He has become a very outstanding, forthright critic of U.S. policy, including the policies of the Bush administration. He was with Colin Powell and part of the staff, the chief of staff, when Colin Powell was preparing and then delivered his speech at the UN, where he was trying to provide what he said was irrefutable proof that Iraq had dangerous weapons of mass destruction when, in fact, they had none. And I asked Lawrence Wilkerson, did you guys really believe that Iraq posed a menace to the United States? I mean, was it really just an intelligence failure? Because, after all, Iraq had been sanctioned for more than a decade. It was hobbled economically. It was completely inspected up and down by thousands and thousands of arms inspectors. It was going through weapons disarmament. Did you really believe that? What really was the thinking of the Bush administration? And he said to me in response, Iraq was the low-hanging fruit, meaning it would be easy. It would be easy to topple Iraq because it was, in fact, so hobbled, so weak. Now, back in 2002, if you can just help people go back there, there was another memorandum, and this also has just come out in the Hillary Clinton email release that the court ordered. There's a document, a memo from the U.S. Embassy to Colin Powell, to the then Secretary of State, and they're talking about the problem of how to bring Britain along in the war effort. And I think this is extremely important, because if Bush could not have counted on the U.K., if they could not have counted on the Blair government, if Bush had to do it all by the United States actions alone, the outcome may have been far different in terms of what the political landscape would have looked like. And so in this memo, it says, however, a sizable number, this is from the U.S. Embassy to Colin Powell, however, a sizable number of his, that's Blair's, Labor Party MPs remain at present opposed to military action against Iraq. A majority indicate that they would change their minds if they had proof of Iraqi involvement in September 11th or another terrorist atrocity. And then they go through why the U.S. should, in its propaganda, emphasize that Iraq was somehow involved with September 11th or possibly complicit with a pending terrorist attack. I mean, it was very important what was going on in the U.K. at that time, and it was a top priority for the Bush administration to bring Blair along.
It was, and Chomsky says in our film that he's not sure that if Blair had not been able to bring Britain along, whether the enterprise would have been able to proceed. In other words, that Blair and Britain were vitally important, perhaps crucially important, decisively important in this great crime that we are discussing now. I think I get an honourable mention in that memorandum that you were quoting from the embassy to Colin Powell. And it was, for a time, in the balance. We got, I think, 139 Labour members of Parliament to oppose the war. Unfortunately, the opposition Conservatives overwhelmingly supported it. But it would have been, nonetheless, a very difficult thing for Blair to go to war with the majority of his own members of Parliament against him.
George Galloway, before we take a quick break, I want to quote that document, because it says opposition to military action against Saddam Hussein goes unfortunately well beyond the usual suspects such as Galloway. That would be our guest, George Galloway. George Galloway, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear. And clear.
We are back with George Galloway, currently running for the mayor of London in an election that will take place in May. Before we went to the break, Mr. Galloway, we were talking about how the United States needed to draw and drag Britain into its partnership in order to invade Iraq in March 2003. And they had Tony Blair, a willing junior partner, I would say, going along with that, making that possible. But again, the decisive importance of the UK, I think, was evidenced again in August, September 2013, 10 years later, when it appeared that the United States was about to go to war against Syria, not against ISIL, not against the so-called Islamic State, not against al-Nusra, not against the Army of Conquest, not against those who have been identified as terrorist organizations now in Syria, but against the Syrian Arab Army and the government of Bashar al-Assad. And the British House of Commons deprived the United States of that necessary alliance. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, again, I had the good luck to be there. I was one of the speakers. There was a purple patch, actually, of four speakers in a row, just by chance. Two conservatives, two on the opposition benches. And those four speeches are widely held to have turned the debate. And Cameron lost by a very narrow number, I think 13. So if seven people had voted the other way, then we would already be at war as ISIL's air force, as Al-Qaeda's air force. That's how absurd this proposition was. And because the British Parliament derailed David Cameron's plan to go to war against the government in Syria, the engines had to be switched off in the bombers in the United States, because as we were talking about earlier, Britain was not just a fig leaf. It's a mistake to, in a way, denigrate Britain as a fig leaf, not least where the fig leaf would have to be hanging for George W. Bush. It was more than that, and it was more than that in 2013. In the Iraq War, the president's brain was missing, and Blair was the president's brain. It's a misnomer to call Blair the poodle of George W. Bush. On the contrary, I believe he was the president's missing brain. Far more eloquent, far more persuasive, far more important in selling the project internationally, and perhaps decisive in that. You asked me earlier, and I didn't properly answer you, what it was all about. And I think for younger listeners, for people perhaps who are catching up on these issues, the project for a new American century, which the neocons took with them into government on the election of George W. Bush, had the goal of ensuring absolute full spectrum dominance and hegemony for the United States across the world, so that no country or collection of countries could even conceivably stand up to American power. And that's a measure of its failure, because far from terrifying the world with American power, the failure in Iraq emboldened people across the world to stand up to American power. Some of them pretty dodgy elements, but nonetheless standing up to American power. Because what was demonstrated in Iraq was not the terrifying strength of the United States, but its new found weakness, a weakness which has only increased in the years since. So in 2013, our parliament, and I think our four speeches, stopped the war. We stopped Britain, and therefore we stopped the United States. But we've now gone backwards. Not only are Britain now participating in the bombardment for nefarious purposes in Syria, but we're about to, I don't know if this is news across the Atlantic, we're about to send ground forces into Libya. What could go wrong? What could go wrong sending more Western soldiers into an invasion of yet another Arab Muslim country? At the same time today, we are discussing whether to send British soldiers back to Afghanistan, because the enemy, which hundreds, thousands of British soldiers gave their blood, their lives, their limbs to fight against, are now back on the verge of power. another of the catastrophes of recent times. So I suppose, Brian, the only thing that really surprises me is how people don't learn any lessons. The journalists, if we may call them that, are repeating exactly the same arguments in favor of invading Syria, invading Libya, reinvading Afghanistan, as they did in the arguments running up to the Iraq war. So what was the reason for the Iraq war? It wasn't just to deal with Saddam Hussein. It wasn't just about oil. It wasn't just about Israel. It was about, and you asked what Powell had in mind in his memo. He had in mind regime change in country after country. Regime change in Iraq, followed by regime change in Syria, in Libya, in Sudan, and the big enchilada, regime change in Iran. Well, they haven't succeeded in any regard in that project. They did change the regime in Libya and produced a worse one. They have failed to change the regime in Syria. They changed the regime in Iraq and produced a much worse situation than existed before. And they've had to cry uncle in the confrontation with Iran and reach an accommodation with Iran.
You know, I have your speech, the speech you made on August 29th, 2013, in front of me, the one before the House of Commons. You said that there were four speeches in particular, giving voice to what was undoubtedly a groundswell of opposition at the grassroots. But every groundswell needs a voice. It needs leadership. And you, in your opening, you said only 11% of the public, according to the Daily Telegraph this morning, supports Britain becoming involved in a war in Syria. Can ever a British government have imagined sending its men and women to war with the support of just 11% in public opinion? And then you continued. I know, because we were all outside the White House, millions of people were opposed to the Syrian war, but there was a sense of inevitability once John Kerry said Assad has crossed the red line. They use chemical weapons, even though they provided no evidence. The Washington Post, which is a neoconservative journal at this point, was demanding action. Once that motion seemed to be set in place, it seemed to be impossible to stop the new bombing of Syria. And yet what the House of Commons did in Britain created such a reinvigoration of opposition in the United States that when Obama was planning to make his announcement, everyone was expecting him to announce the bombing of Syria. He was waiting inside the White House, about to come out to the Rose Garden to make the announcement. But all they could hear in the media over the live feed was no war on Syria. People chanting, people representing a large groundswell of support. And yet we see now, 2 years later, that under the pretext of fighting ISIL, the United States, Britain, France, Germany, all of the major Western powers who have created so much havoc in the Middle East are getting ready to go for endless war in Syria and Iraq with no real plan to win, to defeat ISIL. Because how can you defeat ISIL without partnering with the Syrian Arab Army, which has lost 60 to 85,000 men fighting ISIL and fighting the other terrorist organizations? Why is it now, when the United States seems to have adjusted its, not only its rhetoric, but its posture, why can't they bring themselves to partner with the Syrian government, recognizing that ISIL, in fact, represents a congruent foe for all?
Well, first of all, nothing is inevitable except death and taxes, as Mark Twain said. Everything can be altered by the activity, thought, argument, mobilization of men and women. And that's what we achieved in 2013. That's what we failed to achieve so far this time. I take consolation from the fact that events are marching ineluctably in our direction to vindicate our stand. In other words, each of these interventions is more disastrous than the last. and produces more unintended consequences, which are widely seen in the public's mind to have been worse than the problem that was supposedly being addressed. Secondly, although there are a lot of people who are passive recipients of government decisions, there are more people conscientized, mobilized, and informed in our world today than there have ever been. And I speak as someone of more than 60 years of age who's been in politics for well over 40 years. I can tell you there has never been a time where there were more millions of people in Britain who knew exactly what was going on. And of course, the reason for that is the explosion of social media, new channels like RT, like Sputnik, like Press TV, like many, many others. And the fact is, our rulers and their media echo chamber are no longer able to throw sand in the eyes of everyone. They can perhaps get by to get a decision here and there, but the cost to them in terms of the credibility of their system is higher and higher and higher each time they do it. Now, because I know and you know that the intervention in Syria that they have made cannot possibly succeed because it is ranged against the real material conditions on the ground. The Syrian Arab Army has fought for 5 years, sacrificed so much, is not going to be defeated. Its allies in Russia, in Iran, in the Lebanese resistance are not going to be defeated. The Syrian people who voted with their feet, more than half of them, to go and live in government-controlled areas are never going to consent to be ruled by Al-Qaeda and by ISIS. Syria is simply not that kind of society. We know that the Western effort to use the threat, which is a real one, by the way, of ISIS and Al-Qaeda as a kind of lever to get more deeply involved in Syria, to bring about regime change, we know that that is doomed. And so the governments and the systems that move heaven and earth to lift this huge stone are going to drop it on their own feet all over again. So vindication comes much faster nowadays, Brian, in this new media age. We're already vindicated for the stand we made on Iraq. I believe that we'll be vindicated, already are being vindicated, in the stand that we've made on Syria in record quick time. So I'm very proud of the stand that we made for Syria. I would have been proud of it even if we'd lost. I'm even more proud of it because I'm certain that we are winning. Unfortunately, in the case of Iraq and in the case of Syria and many others, a gigantic price has been paid by the people in those countries. 1 million people died in Iraq, and 1 million died before it as a result of the sanctions, most of them children. And hundreds of thousands have died in Syria. And Syria has been comprehensively destroyed, as if Jurassic Park monsters had been unleashed on a civil society and had torn it to shreds. That's what's happened. That's why I can never forgive these criminals, and why I must describe them as criminals, even to their faces, especially to their faces.
George Galloway, when we have seen since 2011, really at the beginning, the end of 2010, the beginning of what was called the Arab Spring, Tunisia, the Egyptian Revolution, there was so much hope, so much promise that the dictatorships, that the regimes that had been the proxies, really, of Western powers fundamentally, of different political stripes, but nonetheless dependent on Western support, those regimes were under threat from below, from a mass movement, from real people coming into the streets, demanding and using social media, other mechanisms of communication that allowed them to kind of go outside and beyond and around government censorship. there was the promise of a real revolutionary change in the Arab world. Now, I was with you at a conference in Cairo in December 2003. This was after the Iraq invasion. Saddam Hussein had not yet been arrested. He was on the run. He was underground. The conference was against the U.S. war in Iraq. But in the middle of the conference, I think you'll remember this, on December 13th, 2003, it was announced that Saddam Hussein had been arrested. And this conference, which included members of the Muslim Brotherhood and secular socialists and others who considered themselves pan-Arabists, the conference, which had so much unity, almost broke up into fistfights. I don't know if you remember this.
I do.
And it was over the question of how to deal with the arrest by occupation forces of Saddam Hussein. And you had the Muslim Brotherhood, representing political Islamic forces, going almost into the trenches, into fighting at the conference with the secular pan-Arabists who demanded that Saddam Hussein, even if they had many, many political differences with him, should be released, where the Brotherhood people said, no, he should be hung. I mean, it was in a way a precursor of the struggle, which was still in a subterranean way between secular and Islamic forces, which once the political revolution in Egypt really gained power after Mubarak had to leave, that struggle became so irreconcilable that it almost devoured the Arab Spring. And the hopefulness, the euphoria that we felt in January, February, March of 2011 has almost turned into its opposite. What's your take on that?
Well, revolutions, of course, are a process, not an event. And the Arab Revolution hasn't finished yet. And of course, neither can you, when you're taking one step forward, be sure that you won't have to take two steps back.
Sadly, George Galloway, we're going to have to finish your answer when we come back from a brief break. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
We are back with George Galloway, legendary anti-war crusader, currently running for mayor of London. George Galloway, we're talking about the Arab Spring. Go ahead.
Yes, of course, you have uneven development. You have revolution, but you can't guarantee what the forces will be that will prevail. And neither is inevitable progress guaranteed. Of course, you can take one step forward. You may have to take two steps back, maybe many more than two. But I certainly don't believe that the Arab Revolution has finished yet. And of course, the truth is that some of the developments that have taken place have given us a worse situation than we already had. I alluded earlier to the situation in Libya. All of us have different points of view about the Gaddafi regime. I never had very much time for it, but it has undoubtedly been replaced by a far worse situation. Egypt had a democratic election. It elected a president who is now on death row, and Mubarak is out of prison, and his apparatchiks are all back in power in the name of secularism. And some of the liberals who supported the Sisi coup d'etat are themselves now in prison at the hands of Sisi. So nothing is inevitable. Nothing goes smoothly, least of all revolutionary processes. And that's why I say that defeating ISIS and Al-Qaeda is a necessary but not sufficient condition of progress in the Arab world. It is necessary because such forces can only take us in the direction of absolute atomization, with confessional states proliferating, not 23 Arab countries, not even 233, maybe many hundreds of small emirates based on confession, based on religion and sect, fighting each other, being sold weapons by us to both sides, every one of them with an army and an air force and diplomats and all the plethora of Balkanization. We have to defeat ISIS. We have to defeat Al-Qaeda. But that will not be sufficient. If we continue with the status quo ante of dictatorship ruling the Arab world instead of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, then that ISIS-Al-Qaeda phenomenon will merely mutate, metastasize, and come back in an even more, if it's possible to imagine, even more virulent form. Sykes-Picot, the fake division of the Arab world, British and French inspired, Mr. Sykes and Mr. Picot, exactly 100 years ago this week, were sitting drawing the 20th century map of the Arab world for imperial purposes, for their own selfish purposes. Lines that they drew and the puppets that they put on the thrones and later presidential chairs in these countries is the status quo ante, and that is not capable of prevailing. Any attempt to defeat ISIS and Al-Qaeda in the interests of the status quo of these puppet regimes will not survive, and new and terrible horrors will befall the Arab world. So I'm for a grand coalition to defeat ISIS and Al-Qaeda, but I'm also for Arab revolution to overthrow the corrupt, despotic, sclerotic, hopeless, incompetent, and wicked regimes that rule most of the Arab world from the Atlantic to the Gulf.
Well, the Sykes-Picot Treaty was something we learned about accidentally, well, not completely, but there was a revolution in Russia, and the Tsarist government in Russia was the third signer to the Sykes-Picot, but it was gone by February, March 1917, depending on what calendar you're using. And so the new revolutionary government in Russia at that time revealed the existence of the Sykes-Picot Treaty. In other words, the division of the Arab world, the division of the defeated Ottoman territories was done completely, they thought, in secret by those who decided to colonize and dominate that whole region. And as you said, 100 years later, the Middle East is still sort of struggling to get the basic fundamental rights that all people everywhere want, and struggling against regimes that came into power as a consequence of that division of the Arab world. That's why the Kurds, for instance, don't have a state. That's why they're divvied up into four different countries, Iran, Iraq, Syria. And Turkey, of course. And this kind of division, the ISIL is trying to create the idea in their propaganda that they, under the guise of the return of an Islamic caliphate, can destroy the Sykes-Picot borders. In other words, when you look at ISIL propaganda, they're driving a sword in between the borders between Iraq and Syria. They're saying these are colonial borders. But their language, their orientation is so reactionary. It seems to me to be the equivalent in the Middle East of a fascist type ideology. Of course, it's not exactly like Mussolini or Hitler's Nazism, but it represents a fascist menace to the progress of the region. And we had Russia move in with militarily, and I think sort of irreversibly changed the military dynamic, because it then became clear that the targeted government, the Assad government, could not be carried out by regime change. And that the Russian government said, we want Syrians to determine the outcome of Syria. We're not trying to create a puppet government. They demanded, in fact, a political process, which has now been ratified at Vienna too, which would be some parts of the opposition, who perhaps not, of course, ISIL or Al-Qaeda, but others, and the Assad government engaging in ceasefires, possibly local ceasefires, and then a negotiating process, and finally an election after 18 months for a government of national unity. In other words, can there still be a Syrian directed outcome, even if there's international players at the table?
And we could have had all that, of course, almost 5 years ago. Kofi Annan's initiative as the appointed envoy of the United Nations posited exactly that process, which was wrecked by American and British wrecking tactics. They preferred to go for complete victory on the battlefield. They predicted that with monotonous regularity. The Turkish then Foreign Minister Davutoglu used to predict fortnightly that Bashar al-Assad was about to fall. And they sincerely believed that. But finally, after 250,000 dead people, the destruction of at least half of Syria and its ancient civilization, the sending into orbit around the world of a million Syrian refugees, maybe 2, maybe 3 million Syrian refugees, we're finally back where we could have been almost 5 years ago. And that is because of the leadership of President Putin and the diplomacy of Mr. Lavrov. Now, for the avoidance of doubt, I don't actually support the internal domestic policies of President Putin. I've only recently been in Moscow and heard from the people there the very many areas with which I would disagree with President Putin. But in foreign policy, on the international stage, Putin and Lavrov, serving Putin's government, have done something almost miraculous. They have stopped in its tracks a headlong collapse of the Middle East. I believe that they have stopped ISIS and Al-Qaeda in its tracks. And history will record that as a very signal service to humanity indeed. There's many a slip between cup and lip, and there will be much blood, I'm sorry to say, will continue to flow in Syria. But it's possible to see now the defeat on the battlefield of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the other groups like them in both Syria and Iraq. But I repeat what I said a minute ago, that if what happens thereafter is a consolidation of untenable dictatorships, then ISIS and Al-Qaeda will be back. Incidentally, the best comparison is not with Mussolini or Hitler, but with the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, which the British and American governments continued to support even long after Vietnam had assisted in the removal of the Pol Pot dictatorship in Cambodia. ISIS and Al-Qaeda want to return the Arabs and the Muslims to year zero. They want to eliminate and destroy anything beyond year zero, just like Pol Pot did. And it's ironic, isn't it, that Britain and America supported Pol Pot, supported the Khmer Rouge tyranny, which killed millions of people, and they ended up supporting ISIS and Al-Qaeda too.
George Galloway, I want to turn to your campaign in London and also the politics both in the UK and in Europe. But before we do that, I want to spend, we only have about 5 or 6 minutes left, but before I do that, I want to turn for a minute or two, if we could, to what's going on in Palestine. Because you are, I would say, among Western voices, perhaps the most well-known champion of the cause of the Palestinian people. I would say the cause for justice, the cause for self-determination, the cause against occupation. We see an intensifying struggle being undertaken, a reign of terror really being imposed by settlers with the support, in many cases, of the Israeli state against Palestinian people. There is a growing resistance. We've had two intifadas, meaning broad resistance. Are we on the verge of a third intifada? And again, because of the limitation of time, we'll just try to stay on this topic for a minute or two, if we could.
Well, what's happening is familiar to informed Americans, in that this is a colonial project very similar to the destruction of the Native American population at the hands of European settlers in North America. We often say that Israel-Palestine is like South African apartheid, but it's much worse than that. The Boers in South Africa did not intend to physically eliminate and remove the black people in South Africa. In fact, they wanted their labor. They wanted even their custom. They merely wanted to canton them, to separate them for racist reasons from white people. In the case of the settlers, the European settlers in Palestine, they literally have a goal of physically eliminating, and if not eliminating, then removing the native population, just like the settlers did in North America in their day. I was a close friend of President Arafat for decades, and he used to always say, it was politically incorrect language, but he used to say, we are not the Red Indians. We will not go into the museum of X nations. And what he meant was that by resisting, we will continue to exist. And that happened. And that is the greatest achievement of Arafat, God rest his soul. So my opposition to Israeli policies is a part and parcel of my lifelong, as a half an Irishman, my lifelong opposition to colonialism, to the idea that powerful people can go and steal the land of less powerful people, can settle it, can steal their things, and if necessary, can physically eliminate any and all opposition to it. So the Palestinians will never surrender. There will never be a time when the Palestinians go to the reservation and stay out of sight. And they have kept themselves right at the top of the international political agenda now for decades, and no one seriously believes they're ever going to leave that. So until there is justice in Palestine, there will be no peace in the Middle East.
George Galloway, the Obama administration, when it came in, told the Israeli government, stop building settlements. They appointed George Mitchell, a former senior member of the Senate Democratic Party, to be a negotiator. 7 years later, Netanyahu treats Obama with contempt. He's got allies with the Republican Party. But certainly nothing that the Obama administration demanded of Netanyahu has been implemented. Not that they demanded it very strongly. Israel is the recipient of $3.5 billion per year. It's the largest recipient of any government of U.S. foreign aid. Is there a way in which you could see that the Israeli government, even as a colonial project, could at some point, rather than be seen as an asset of imperial power, be seen as a liability?
I do think so. And the chairman of the Armed Services Committee in the United States Congress used exactly those words, that the U.S. relationship with Israel had been a strategic asset, but had now become a strategic liability. And I believe that that is true. But none of these crimes that have been committed against the Palestinian people could have been committed if not for Britain and the United States. I'm afraid it's the old duet. Britain brought this great crime into being, promising on behalf of one people to a second people the land that belonged to a third people, something unique even in imperial history. And the United States has gone on paying for it since you became top dog after the Second World War.
George, I want to leave that because it turns out we have just maybe 90 seconds left. I want to talk for the last minute and a half about your own campaign. You said in October 2015, I believe it's a tweet, if I'm the mayor, London will be the peace capital of the world. No to war, invasion, occupation, and injustice. No more arms fairs in London. And you also said that Londoners want someone who's not a creature of the party's political machine. Tell us in a moment about your campaign and what you think there.
Well, as you encapsulated it, that's quite a good manifesto, I think, even if I had nothing more to say, which I, of course, do. I have acres of other things to say. But we will declare peace on the world. We will oppose all occupation and unjust war anywhere in the world. And we'll also defend ourselves against anyone from the ISIS, Al-Qaeda phenomenon who want to come here and hurt us. We'll be tough on terrorism, but we'll be tough on the causes of terrorism too. I think London needs a leader, not a reader. I'll employ people to do the reading. I'll be doing the leading. And the leading that we have in mind is to build a London for all, not just those dripping in gold, not just the 1% who are already dripping in gold. They don't need a mayor. They're already rich and powerful enough. It's the mass of the people who've gained virtually nothing from the era in which London came to be dripping in gold.
George Galloway, I want to thank you. That's all the time we have for today. We were joined for the full hour by legendary anti-war crusader George Galloway. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.